WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her recent bestseller about writing called Bird by Bird, Anne Lamott warns that two conflicting feelings are likely to compete in a writer's head, self-aggrandizement and self-loathing. Lamott is very attuned to the confusing messages that play in her head, and that's part of what her readers respond to. She described her inner life in her other bestseller, Operating Instructions. It was a memoir of her son's first year and her first year as a mother, a single mother, in her mid-30s. Now Lamott has a book called Crooked Little Heart. Although it's a novel, there are many facets of the two main characters that are based on her own experiences. The mother, Elizabeth, is like Lamott, a recovering alcoholic. The 13-year-old daughter, Rosie, plays on the junior tennis circuit like Lamott used to. Anne Lamott first wrote about these characters in her earlier novel, Rosie. I asked Lamott if she used to be a good tennis player.
I was really good athletically, and I didn't have the head for it, as Rosie doesn't have the head. I was very good at doubles because I didn't mind. I guess I was just so much more relieved to have somebody to share the failure with when it didn't go so well. But my doubles partner was only a little bit better than I was athletically, but she had the head of a champion. You know, it's like in Crooked Little Heart, it talks about how Rosie's partner, Simone, goes out onto the court and she just assumes she's going to win, you know, and my doubles partner just assumed that she was going to win, even if she was playing somebody better than she was. And I would go out there and my head would just start spinning, you know. It would be like some terrible tiny little breakdown that I'd be having, and my arms would become sort of vaguely arthritic behind the anxiety, and the jungle drums would start beating and my game would fall apart. And I could often pull myself back together, but I didn't have the head of a champion is the best way I can say it.
Did you not like the competitive aspect of it? I mean, did you feel like insecurity and competition didn't go very well together?
Well, I always was a great achiever, you know. I was very, very good in school, and I was very highly ranked for all those years that I was playing, but I was always really freaked out by both things. And it's for me in competition, there's never enough. It's never good enough. You know, there's that whole section in Bird by Bird about how B pluses are actually a really good grade, but that I was 35 when I discovered this, and I grew up getting mostly A's and A minuses and just wanting to hang myself when I brought home B pluses. And it was the same with my tennis rankings, that if I was in the top 10, it was B plus. And if I was in the top 7, it was A or A minus, because at the end of the year in Northern California, they had a Christmas round robin for the top 7 ranked players. So if you didn't get the letter inviting you to the round robin, you thought of yourself as such a loser. But I also think, I don't think it's a very natural thing for a lot of us. I think there are certain kids that are just born to compete, and it helps them get better and better and really compete against themselves. But I wasn't that well. I think I was maybe a little bit mentally ill or something.
Now, your character, the 13-year-old Rosie, cheats.
Right.
Book. I hope you don't mind me giving that away. But I'm wondering if you did that too, or if you had a friend who did, if there was the temptation to do it in order to look good and achieve.
You know, I did it for a season. It was something that began to happen when I was 13 also, and it was almost an accident, like it is for Rosie, where I was playing somebody who wasn't very good and who I'd never heard of before, and my head was just nuts. You know, it was like I was prematurely channeling, you know, like the Unabomber or something. You know, my head was pounding and I couldn't find my game. And my head it was like this terrible staticky radio station. And the girl, I can't remember her name, but I can picture her face, hit a ball that went just touched the line, really ticked the baseline. And in tennis, you know, if the ball touches an angstrom unit of the line, it's in. And it was clearly in. It was more than an angstrom unit. It was probably right on the line. And she had happened to look up for a second. And her mother was doing something else, like pouring herself some coffee. And I said, out. I didn't even notice what happened. I said, out. She said, it was. And I said, yeah. And she let it go. I mean, please. I thought I had discovered the secret of life. And it turned things around for me because I began to feel this sense of power. I began to feel that I had a little bit of control in the game. And I didn't cheat again in that game. And I didn't cheat again in that tournament. I was deeply afraid. I mean, at that age, my friends were starting to shoplift, and I couldn't do it. I just didn't have the nerves. But I remember at the next tournament, something came up where a point could have really made or break or broken the match for me, and it was very close again, and I said, out. And I remember her challenging me, and I said, I'm sorry, I saw it. And I pointed to an imaginary spot next to the alley line and said, it hit right here. And there's nothing she could do. There aren't people calling the shots for you in preliminary matches. So I got into it, and I think I did it for most of a year. I've blocked a lot of it out. It was extremely painful. And I didn't actually consciously think about it until I was in my mid-20s, and it started coming back to me like a terrible, terrible nightmare. But it is true, and it is where I got the idea for Crooked Little Heart.
You recovered memories about tennis.
Yeah, I know, please. There's probably a book in it.
Oh, God, I mean, you strike me as somebody who's probably so prone to guilt. I'm amazed you were able to pull this off for a year.
I know. I'm the most guilt-racked human on earth. I mean, I was just tortured, you know. I was like this little junior Lady Macbeth, and I'd be walking around wringing my hands out and trying to get the blood off of them. And I, you know, it's like with everything that I've ever done that I knew was really wrong or really that I felt that I couldn't stop doing, I'd always feel like it was the last time. I had a long bout with an eating disorder in my 20s right after my dad got sick. And I can remember every single time I think, I'm never going to do it again. And I'd pray. I mean, I always believed in God. You know, I believed in God at 13. I'd go, please, please don't let me do that again. And something would come up. I'd be all right for a little stretch. And then this whole cycle would start up. I'd be playing someone that I might be seated much higher than this person or ranked higher and expected to win. And I felt such anxiety about doing well and making the family look good. And the jungle drums would start beating. And it would be a very important point. And if I won the game, I'd be an infinitely better psychological shape when we change sides or something. And I'd do it. And I started getting noticed by the opponent's mothers. And I remember one of them came up to me when I beat her daughter, who actually went on to be a champion, and she said, Annie, that's not really winning. And I looked at her like, how crazy is this woman? I said, excuse me? You know, but it was, I was flushed with shame. I was absolutely flushed with shame.
How did you stop cheating?
Well, a wonderful thing happened, which is that somebody showed up and told the truth to my mom, and they downplayed it enough so that I didn't have to entirely look like it things were going as poorly as they were, which was, I was pretty afraid a lot of the time, and I was very sad about it. I was very confused about what was happening because I was really a very good tennis player. And the person mentioned to my mother that I was having some problems with my line calls, and my mother mentioned it to me, and you know, the trance just broke. It was like somebody had taken a pin and burst the soap bubble of denial and delusion that I had around me, and I wept and wept and wept. And then I went through a long stage like Rosie does towards the end of the book, where I was calling balls in that my opponent hit that were like all but hitting the back fence. You know, I was overcompensating so much. And then, you know, one of the things that I knew about Rosie, about Crooked Little Heart when I started, was that the climactic moment was going to be so quiet, and it was going to have to do with Rosie calling a ball out that was out by just a little. You know, that after all of this mishigas involving her cheating and then overcompensating, that finally she was going to be able to look at something and say out loud what was true about it. That it was a ball that her opponent thought was in, that would have won her opponent the match, that she was going to be able to say, you know what, it was out. So now I've given away the whole plot.
No, let's worry about it.
Okay, let me call my therapist quickly.
Anne Lamott is my guest, and her new novel is called Crooked Little Heart. Anne, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anne Lamott. Her new novel is called Crooked Little Heart, and she's also the author of two bestsellers, Operating Instructions, which is a memoir about the first year of her son's life, and also Bird by Bird, which is a book about writing. Crooked Little Heart is your second novel with the characters of Elizabeth and her daughter, Rosie. When you wrote the first novel with those two characters, you were still drinking a lot. What was the difference to you writing about these characters sober and writing about them when you were drinking?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't actually sit at the typewriter every morning slamming down social drinks while I wrote, but I was hungover most mornings, and I was in that state of anxiety and self-loathing that you're in when you're on a downward spiral, which I was. And so, for instance, at the end of Rosie, Elizabeth gets sober, and I needed to talk to sober alcoholics to find out what that might be like, because I, in fact, didn't get sober for 4 more years after that. And I hadn't had a child, so I had to talk to parents about what that was like. And then when I started writing Crooked Little Heart, I had both been sober for quite a long time, and I'd had been a mother for a long time. Another thing about having gotten sober was that my mind started coming back, you know, such as it is. And when I was drinking, I felt very addled all the time. You know, I had a friend whose father used to tap his head and say, crab salad, and I kind of got what that meant. And when I got sober, I really did feel like my windows had been washed and that one day at a time the pond was settling down a little bit. And then another thing was that after I got sober, and especially after I had Sam, I really learned to get along with myself a lot better. And I think maybe I just stopped caring as much, or I was too tired to obsess about it the way I had before. But I started to realize that there was a great deal of grief in me that I had never gotten around to dealing with. You know, my father died of brain cancer when I was 25, and I had just adored him. And then when Sam was 2, my best friend died. And there had really never been time to go ahead and just experience that huge ocean of sorrow before. And I believe that it kept me in a somewhat more skittish and isolated place. And that after I'd been sober for a while and been a mother for a little while, I somehow got the confidence to go ahead and really, really grieve. And it took a while, and it was very inconvenient, and people kept wanting for me to feel better before I did. You know, it's like, can we pick up the pace here at all? And I really stayed quite stricken and miserable for a long time. And when I began to come back a little bit, I felt like life sort of reached down and held out its hand to me and pulled me back to my feet. And I was not the same woman who I had been when I went down into that that abyss that I had been avoiding for so long. So I felt that the effect of sobriety and motherhood was to give me the stamina to feel a lot worse than I had ever felt before. And that, in turn, gave me a real shot at beginning to experience things, you know, to life and presence with some sort of spaciousness. And I was able to pay attention to it more because I was no longer trying to hide from it, because I was so afraid that it would wash me away, that the grief was this black river of feelings that would, you know, push me out past the Golden Gate Bridge and maybe kill me. I knew, in fact, that the grief was going to somehow be some sort of inside shower, you know, that it was going to somehow hydrate the ground at my feet, and that things were going to grow differently than they had before. And I really think that turned out to be what happened before I started Crooked Little Heart. And I wrote a long piece about it, in fact, that was about grief and about how grief is the way home, that ended up being a theme treatment for the novel.
Do you think that the tone of your writing has changed since you gave up drinking?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think that I had such low self-esteem when I was drinking. I mean, I was very conceited. I know you're not supposed to use the word conceited after you leave eighth grade, but I was very conceited. I was the egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And in that,
there's a lot of that in the art world, by the way. I think so many artists have this strange combination of egomania, self-absorption, and low self-esteem and insecurity.
Oh, I think so, too. Yeah. Oh, I think so, too. I think that about 85% of art springs from that particular swimming pool. But anyway, when I was there, one of the ways that I dealt with it, besides this sort of pathological people-pleasing, was that I tried to appear to be funny and on top of things and just the snappiest piece of cheese that you could ever hope to be in the company of. And so when a lot of sad things happened in Rosie, which they do, you know, Rosie, in the novel Rosie, Rosie's molested by her best friend's father, Rosie's father dies, Elizabeth's husband Andrew dies when Rosie's 4, and Rosie's best friend moves away, and there's just a lot of the day-to-day sorrow that we all experience. I didn't really have the wherewithal or the center of gravity to bear it. And so what happens a number of times in Rosie is this very deep, kind of pure, emotional, sad stuff comes up, and I do it for a few sentences, and then right away I want to shift the tone so that you can really see that I'm fine and I'm not so sad and I'm not lugubrious and I'm not Charlotte Bronte with PMS. I'm this wonderful, happy, okay person. And I didn't do that in Crooked Little Heart. I thought, I just want to stay with it and see where it takes me. You know, it's like being in the woods and wanting to bolt out of there because it's dark and spooky. And instead, it's like mysterious and bejeweled in the darkness and the shadow. And then when you step back out of it, finally, everything is so newly washed and fresh that it's a real gift, I think. I love it when other writers take me through that process and they don't feel like they need to be snappy and happening, but they instead say, this is what I saw, this is what I felt like, this is what I know, here's a little map of what it was like for me. I think maybe you want to be careful when you go around that one corner because it's a very sheer drop, but you're going to go through these woods and you're going to be very frightened, and I want to tell you that I wouldn't have missed them for the world.
You know, you wrote this new novel, Crooked Little Heart, after Bird by Bird. Or maybe you wrote it while you were writing Bird by Bird. But anyways, by the time this came out, Bird by Bird had already been a bestseller in hardcover and paperback. And that was your book about writing and your book of advice to writers and would-be writers. And I'm thinking, you know, while you were, you know, so successful with Bird by Bird, your book about writing, was it really a challenge to write your new novel, Crooked Little Heart? Was there this voice in your head scolding you, saying, okay, Miss Know-It-All, Miss Know-Everything about how to write. Yeah, sure, muddle your way through this next novel. Let's see how that turns out.
Yeah, there was. I was really panic-stricken. I thought people would read this new book and think, oh, you know, bore me later, please. You know, this is the best you could do. I'm really impressed. But, you know, there's whole chapters in Bird by Bird about quieting the voices of the critics and of your parents and of, you know, and quieting all of the voices, but the voice of the characters that are tugging on your sleeves, trying to use you to get their stories written. You know, they're using you. You're their little Rosemary Woods, and they can't get their story told without you. And when you quiet down and the pond settles, then you can hear very clearly who they are and what they have to say. And, but, you know, the two main things from Bird by Bird really did serve me. One was that you take short assignments, and one was that you let yourself write really, really awful drafts. And I wrote unbelievably bad drafts of it. I wrote such bad drafts that the panic was almost, you know, almost annihilating. And I think that's it. The well is run dry. The jig is up. I will have to work for the phone company. I have no better clothes than I did before I wrote operating instructions, you know. But then after a year of working on what turned out to be Crooked Little Heart, I ended up doing the writing book for a number of reasons, and I wrote it very quickly. And so when I got back to the novel, I had a year's worth of material. So therefore, I didn't have the very worst enemy, which we have, which is all that blank paper, you know, the unassaulted ice flow of a project not yet begun. And then I wrote an unbelievably bad first draft. And then you know what? I wrote an unbelievably bad second draft. And then I wrote a third draft that I thought was basically word perfect, and I sent it to my agent, Chuck. I sent it on a Thursday, and I always send things FedEx overnight because I'm not really well enough to wait for the post office or the afternoon delivery. And when I woke up that morning, that next morning at 7:30, the red light on my machine was already blinking, and it was Chuck. And he said, oh, Annie, oh, my God, I've been reading your book. It is such a trip. It is the book I always knew you were going to write someday. I love it. I'm so excited. We've got to get the movie people in now. Now, and it went on and on like this. Then there was this terrible little pause. And he said, I'm on page 10. And by about page 17, things began to fall apart for him, to the extent that 2 weeks later, on a Monday, he was on page 200. And on a Thursday, he was on 208. So that was the third draft, and this really helped and amused my writing students to no end. And then I wrote a really solid fourth draft, and at that point, my editor, Robin, stepped in, and we pushed back our sleeves and began doing the fine-tuning and the shaving and really, you know, what Jessica Mitford calls killing your little darlings, you know, taking out the parts that I love because I thought they made me look so insightful and witty. So it was funny because this book was really exactly what I wrote about in Bird by Bird, you know, that it doesn't happen as an act of magic. It happens as this very drudgy, keeping your butt on the chair every day and calling people because the whole system works because not everybody's depressed or mentally ill on the same day. So I'd be ready to give up, and I'd call someone who was having a good day, and they'd say, you know what, I love that story you told me about Rosie and Luther on the tennis court. You know, could you just write that today? And I said, no, I think it's all hopeless, and it's all over, and the sun's burning out, and I just think I'm going to have to give all the money back, but I think I spent it. And they'd say, I know, honey, but why don't you just write that one scene anyway? And then I would, and then I'd start to get a little bit back into the saddle.
Well, Anne Lamott, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Anne Lamott's new novel is called Crooked Little Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.